Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 13th of June. Our main stories: Brazil now has the second highest number of coronavirus deaths in the world after the US. The governor of New York State has ordered police departments to undertake major reforms. And the Italian Prime Minister is questioned by prosecutors about delays in imposing lockdowns. Also in the podcast, how organised crime is benefiting from COVID-19. And
to do what I do, I need some idea of the threat we face.
Is this key to reopening cinemas around the world? They are the figures the Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, did not want to see when he told the government to stop publishing coronavirus numbers. However, that order was overturned, and on Friday evening, the health ministry announced another 909 deaths from COVID-19, taking the overall figure in Brazil to 41,828, the second highest in the world after the US and now ahead of the UK. Brazil has nearly 830,000 infections, second only to the US as well. And some parts of the Brazilian health system are under strain. Michael Ryan is head of the WHO's Health Emergencies Programme.
The situation in Brazil is of concern. All 27 areas are affected. We've seen different rates of infection. There are clear hotspots in heavily populated areas. There are clearly differential impacts in different populations. We've seen the impact in Amazonas. But overall, the health system is still coping in Brazil.
I heard more from our Sao Paulo correspondent, Katie Watson.
It was a number that everybody here was predicting. Everybody here was also, you know, deeply concerned, knowing, if you like, that this is going to happen. Jair Bolsonaro has continued to downplay this virus. He has said very little this week. And in fact, it's got to such a point that people here, you know, you've got Sao Paulo, you've got Rio, you've got these cities that are starting to reopen at the time of crisis. People here are deeply concerned about where this is going, and we hear very little from the top.
We've had that warning about hotspots from the WHO's Michael Ryan, and he says that some intensive care units are at critical levels.
Absolutely, and he mentioned Amazonas up in the Amazon region. Manaus was one of the cities a month or so ago that was, you know, really hard hit there. They've got some of the highest infection rates. Here in Sao Paulo, it's the epicentre in terms of pure absolute numbers. And that's something that Mr. Ryan also talked about, that they're still coping, because here in Sao Paulo, it's a massive city, the biggest city in the Southern Hemisphere. So their health system is managing at the moment. But he did mention the fact that there are some hotspots and more populated areas where occupancy rates are 90% or more. And that is the concern, of course. We don't know where we are in terms of the curve. Brazil tests very little. And the belief is that the real numbers are much, much higher than the official figures are giving out.
Of course, Brazil also has a big population, and it is a big country. So it should ultimately be able to cope, should it?
The fact that it is such a big country is also one of the biggest challenges. There are, you know, the south of Brazil is so very different from up in the north. And I was talking to one infectologist who said that one of the big issues is just getting like tests down from areas such as the Amazon, because transport logistics makes things much more difficult, and therefore the tests get ruined. I mean, it's the logistics as well, which is causing a big challenge for Brazil, getting ventilators, getting equipment that's needed across the whole of the country. Now, the government has erred, could have done a lot more to help, but I think also the size, the scale, and the difference in the country certainly doesn't help its cause.
Katie Watson in Sao Paulo. I can't breathe, the last words of George Floyd as he suffocated under the knee of a police officer last month, first became a rallying cry in 2014. Protesters chanted it after an African-American man called Eric Garner died in a police chokehold in New York City. On Monday, the New York Assembly passed the Eric Garner Anti-Chokehold Act. On Friday, the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, ordered police departments across the state to implement root and branch reform.
They must formulate a plan They have to address the use of force by police officers, crowd management, community policing, bias awareness, de-escalation, restorative justice, community-based outreach. They have to have a transparent citizen complaint disposition procedure. So if you make a complaint, it's not just yelling out the window. You find out what happened to that complaint. They should talk about appropriate equipment, what's not appropriate equipment, and any other issue that that community believes is relevant.
And Mr. Cuomo said failure to take action in time would have financial consequences.
That plan then has to be enacted into local law. Every city, every county, it has to be done by April 1. If it's not done by April 1, and if it's not passed, they're not going to be eligible for state funding. Period.
One police department that has already transformed itself is Camden, New Jersey, across the Delaware River from Philadelphia. In 2010, the city of Camden was considered one of the most dangerous in America, with a reputation for bad policing. Now, the crime rate has nearly halved after the police department was disbanded and rebuilt. So how did they do it? Lou Capelli, a Camden official, spearheaded the reforms.
We dissolved the previous city police department, Camden City Police Department, in 2012 because of fiscal crisis and public safety crisis. What we did is then form a county police department based on community policing. We had input from residents, from leaders within the city, and we actually had total reform in the new police department by starting over, by hitting the reset button. We had new union contracts, new rules and regulations that allowed us to implement our philosophy that police officers should be guardians and not warriors.
What kind of opposition did you get from the police union?
We had a lot of opposition. We had opposition for 2 years, death threats, damage to property. We were told it'll never happen, but we had bipartisan support from the state of New Jersey, and we made it happen.
What's been the root change in public attitudes to the police?
You know, it's been a complete change of culture in the police and in the way the police are viewed by our residents. We have a true partnership with our residents. And really, the number one reason why crime has dipped so low is that partnership with residents who now trust our officers and are able to talk to them directly instead of fear them.
It sounds idealistic almost. Tell me how the partnership works on a day-to-day basis.
Well, it could be anything from officers just knocking door to door, checking on people, introducing themselves in neighborhoods they are patrolling, pop-up block parties that the police have with residents, reading in schools, movie nights for families, free ice cream for children. It's day-to-day contact in a positive fashion.
And you're telling me that all these things, which seem laudable but relatively minor changes in the way the police treat the public, have actually transformed the general view of the police. They've removed negativity that presumably exists just over the water in Philadelphia.
Oh, really has. Before we started this, it was an us versus them mentality with the city police department. Now it's a true partnership. And, you know, so far, we still have challenges, don't get me wrong. But things are moving in the right direction. We have $2.5 billion of new investment in the city and the highest employment rates in decades.
What happened to the police officers? Did you sack them and reemploy most of them? How did it work?
No, out of the 260 that were fired, we reemployed 100 of them. We invited most of them to apply to the new department. Some of them we did not invite. But of those who applied, we did hire 100. In addition to that, we hired 70 new officers who were minorities and better reflected the community that they serve. So we increased the police force from 260 to 400 officers at the same budget of $63 million.
Lou Capelli talking to the BBC's Paul Henley. In London on Friday, hundreds of Black Lives Matter protesters took to the streets to show solidarity with campaigners in the US.
Institutional racism drives poverty. Poverty drives crime. Crime drives violence.
A larger protest planned for Saturday afternoon was called off over fears of clashes with extremist groups. Our correspondent Chichi Izundu spoke to me from Friday's demonstration in central London.
I am here on Trafalgar Square, where today's protest is slightly coming to an end, actually in a collective dance. Everyone just broke into dance, having just heard a couple of speeches. But I don't know if you can hear the chanting behind me, where people are still saying Black Lives Matter, and they're still here. And there is a police presence here. I wouldn't call it a heavy police presence, but there is a police presence. And now organisers are asking people to disperse and go home.
And this protest did go ahead, but tomorrow's has been cancelled over fears of a counter-protest by right-wing demonstrators.
Tomorrow's was cancelled and organisers moved it to today, as you say, over fears that there may be clashes with people who have decided that it is their job to defend statues and monuments that have had to be boarded up over their fears to historical links to slavery or racism. And the police were quite concerned, as was London's Mayor Sadiq Khan. He asked people to stay home, largely because we are still in a health pandemic and COVID-19 is still a real and present threat, and he didn't want large groups of people congregating in a small area. So he asked people to stay home, but as did the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who also said that he wanted people to stay home and that it was shameful that he's had to board up some of the monuments and statues in central London.
Yeah, of course, we are seeing many ordinary people who've voiced their worries that too many statues are being brought down. Where does the argument go from here?
Well, this is the big question, because the organisers of today's march are concerned that the conversation around Black Lives and their protests are being focused a little too much on the statues, whether they should stay up, whether they should come down. And what they want is the focus to shift back to where they can progress with equality and other demands that they're making. So as to what happens with the statues, who knows? But there is still a lot of conversation about what happens with statues. And it's not just a London issue. In Bristol, one statue of a black poet was actually doused in bleach. Here in London, the monument to Thomas Guy, who opened Guy St. Thomas Hospital in central London, has been boarded up over fears that that may be attacked or defaced or taken down. So there are a number of statues around the country that are having to be boarded up or have 24-hour security at its place over fears that people who want to deface them may go ahead.
Chichi Izundu in central London. This is the Global News podcast from the BBC World Service. Still to come:
the idea is to confront visitors with such important traces of the past, but at the same time with the impossibility of dealing with it.
The new art exhibition inspired by the diary of a former Serb military leader. Even as governments around the world wrestle with the challenge of when to lift coronavirus restrictions, questions are being asked about if the initial lockdowns were imposed early enough. In the UK, a top scientist has said swift action could have cut the number of deaths in half. Now, the Italian Prime Minister has been questioned about his government's response in the early days of the outbreak in northern Italy. Giuseppe Conte was interviewed by prosecutors looking at whether the government should be held to account for not imposing a lockdown sooner. I spoke to our correspondent in Rome, Mark Lowen.
This goes back to when coronavirus erupted in northern Italy. Ollie, you might remember 23rd of February or thereabouts, when northern Italy became, in effect, the sort of Wuhan of the West, the first part of Europe to see a major outbreak of coronavirus, which then spread across Europe and across the world. Now, the first town that was hit, Codogno, saw a red zone, a lockdown very quickly, and so the outbreak was soon contained around that area. But the second major area, it was a city called Bergamo in northern Italy, which is a much bigger place than Codogno, and it's also Italy's second richest city. And there, pressure from business groups unwilling to see economic activity limited in the area, a kind of passing of the buck between national and local politicians, meant that the decision to close that area was delayed by some 2 weeks, actually, until a national lockdown was imposed. And Bergamo paid the price very, very dearly.
Yeah, because senior officials in the region of Lombardy, where Bergamo is, they say it was up to the authorities in Rome to decide whether areas should be shut.
Yeah, I've just been in Lombardy, actually, and everybody seems to say, well, you know, the responsibility lay elsewhere on who had the potential, who had the responsibility, who had the ability to lock down around Bergamo. So it's going to be hard to get to the bottom of this. But, you know, 4 months, basically, or almost 4 months after coronavirus gripped this country and strangled it, really, and over 34,000 deaths later, there is, I think, now a desire for some element of sort of investigation, some inquiries with the benefit of hindsight to see what went wrong and how that could have been avoided or lessened at the start.
Yeah, could this ultimately lead to charges? Because this, of course, is an issue affecting lots of countries around the world.
It's not clear whether criminal charges obviously would be brought, and also politicians, serving ministers here have immunity from prosecution. And of course, the wheels of Italian justice move notoriously slowly. But yeah, I mean, you know, there will be a desire to reach some kind of conclusion, as there is in so many countries at the moment, not least where you are, Ollie, in Britain, where there are other questions about, you know, the timing of the lockdown.
Mark Lowen. Over in the Caribbean, the spread of the coronavirus appears to be largely under control in Cuba. The island registered no COVID-19 deaths for 12 days in a row, and the communist government has unveiled a plan for a gradual reopening. But the economic impact for a country so heavily dependent on tourist dollars will be significant, as our Havana correspondent Will Grant reports.
Doctor, buenos días.
Following 7 consecutive days of no COVID-19 related deaths in May, Cuba appears to have largely contained the spread of the virus. However, the island's leading epidemiologist, Dr. Francisco Duran, said the lockdown rules wouldn't be eased just yet. It isn't time to let our guard down, said Dr. Duran, adding that Cuba would continue to take measures to slow the advance of the disease. Havana's famous sea wall, the Malecón, normally bustles with life as tourists mingle with Cubans over a drink and a chat. But with no prospect of the airports being reopened for now, the Malecón lies empty, and Cuba's economy could contract by 6% this year. The country's private sector is at particular risk. Some estimates suggest 1 in 3 private businesses face closure. Inside Fumiyaki, a Japanese restaurant in Havana, homemade meat dumplings sizzle in hot oil. The owner, Israel Tejedo, says he's had to turn to home delivery and slash his prices in half to stay afloat.
That's the way to keep running the business. It's less work, less salary, but it's something, it's better than nothing.
While Fumiyaki may be able to innovate and pivot towards motorcycle couriers, many businesses can't. From private homes offering tourist accommodation to clothing stores to taxi drivers, for many thousands of Cuban families, the main source of income has dried up.
I think probably that number of a third of the private enterprises not operating is underestimating how many families are affected.
Dr. Emily Morris is an economist and research fellow at the University College London.
So less so the restaurant owner who might have done well over the past decade, but perhaps his or her cook and their cleaning staff and their waiting staff, that kind of a picture.
All of those people, and of course a lot of people were doing up their houses with the proceeds, and so there's a lot of people working in construction informally as well. Those people are sitting at home doing nothing with no work income coming in. There is social assistance, but if that goes on too long, that's going to create serious hardship.
Normally, the private sector and the state in Cuba aren't close bedfellows, with mutual distrust and wariness on both sides. But in the current crisis, some private businesses have pitched in to help the Cuban state. Artist and sculptor Rafael Pérez Alonso has produced around 10,000 plastic face shields. In his studio and gallery space called La Lavandería, a team of volunteers joined him in producing PPE to supply to local hospitals. We donated some of the plastic and PVC, but as we got going, the raw materials started to come from the healthcare system itself, he explained. As Rafael loads up another batch of plastic face shields for a nearby health centre, coronavirus has shown that the private sector and the state in Cuba can work together on a common goal, especially when times are tough. When Cuba emerges from its lockdown, the state may need to recognise that and offer more support to a sector it has always seen as a competitor.
Will Grant reporting. As the world went into lockdown, crime rates tended to plummet dramatically. But over time, the virus has created new criminal opportunities. From drug dealers to counterfeiters to loan sharks, there's been a systematic empowerment of organised crime in particular. Misha Glenny is a journalist who writes about the mafia. He told my colleague Paul Henley about the shortages that criminals were able to profit from.
Marijuana, cocaine and heroin. There was a particular rush here in the United States and around Europe for marijuana, as people realised they were going to be in lockdown probably for a matter of months, and they needed to get their stash before it happened. There has been a shift as a consequence of this, and that is people have started to use the dark net to buy their drugs. Obviously, you don't have to leave your home during lockdown, but also because the dark net supplies drugs via courier services like DHL and DPD and the post office. And so you get the drugs delivered to your home. The police don't have the capacity to monitor this trade. And so now here in the UK, and it's roughly the same in Europe as well, over a quarter of the illicit drugs consumed are sold in this way.
Now, after this panic buying of criminal products, there was a lull even in organised criminal activity, wasn't there? Especially among bosses, I hear, who were aware they had underlying medical conditions. They were taking the government's advice.
So this, I was talking to police officers who specialise in organised crime in Europe and the United Kingdom, and they all said the same thing, that criminals were taking the lockdown very seriously because, you know, criminals are human beings and they didn't want to catch the virus, so they stayed at home. And then most of their main targets were being very assiduous about the lockdown because they had underlying comorbidities such as being overweight or being over 60. So they were being extremely good citizens during the lockdown.
Subsequently, there's been a massive increase in scamming sites, haven't there? Of course, the black market opportunities were huge.
The point is that when you have an economic crisis that is combined with a general sense of public panic, this is a golden opportunity for criminals to exploit the anxieties and the concerns of the public by operating scams. And because of the internet, it's particularly easy to do that. So at first, if you remember, it was extremely difficult to get hold of hand sanitizing gel and face masks and other PPE. The biggest scam of all was from a French company that was desperately trying to source personal protective equipment. And they spent something in the region of 50 million euros trying to get a huge consignment for Singapore. And the whole thing was a fantasy and they lost the money.
Crime expert Misha Glenny. The diary of a former Serb military leader, Ratko Mladic, is the inspiration for a new art exhibition in the Serbian capital, Belgrade. Mladic wrote the journal in hiding after the wars of the 1990s. The Hague Tribunal convicted him of genocide 3 years ago and sentenced him to life in prison. Here's our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay.
The exhibition is simply called Notebook and consists of 400 pages recreated from Ratko Mladic's diary. They're individually framed and displayed in rows which stretch from floor to ceiling, filling up all the available wall space in a small Belgrade gallery. Artist Vladimir Miladinovic is behind the work. He says that the idea is to confront visitors with such important traces of the past, but at the same time with the impossibility of dealing with it. The diary helped to convict Mladic on genocide charges in 2017. His appeal was due to be heard this month, but it's been postponed until next year.
Guy Delaunay. Tens of thousands of cinemas across the world closed because of the COVID-19 pandemic, but in some countries they've now reopened or are about to do so. The industry is putting a lot of faith in one particular blockbuster to get audiences back, director Christopher Nolan's new spy thriller Tenet. But will people feel confident about returning to movie theatres? Here's our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd.
All I have for you is a word.
Since new movie releases all but dried up in March,
Tenet. It'll open the right doors.
The word Tenet has come to be regarded as key to the reopening of cinema doors around the world.
To do what I do, I need some idea of the threat we face.
The industry needs the film, tentatively scheduled for release on July the 17th, to show cinemas are back in business.
Hasn't happened yet.
Director Christopher Nolan is an evangelist for the big screen, says Louise Tutt of trade magazine Screen International.
He will very much want to be the filmmaker that gets 2020 back on track. But Warner Brothers are going to be looking at this every single day because it's going to be a cold, hard business decision. They need about 80% of cinemas around the world open and showing this film. It's going to have to be out everywhere all at the same time. That's a big ask for July the 17th.
Do you know why the Phoenix sits on the right hand of the Emperor? She is his guardian, his protector.
Disney's live-action Mulan could prove vital to tempting back families. Louise Tutt thinks social distancing means we'll find big releases playing to thinned-out audiences, but on more screens than before.
If there aren't many other titles out, you can keep playing that film. So you just have more and more screenings of it. It stays on the cinema for longer. It just takes people longer to go and see it. That is what distributors and exhibitors will be hoping if audiences go back to the cinema in a socially distant way. I think independent distributors are hoping that there'll be room for their films to get on screens. And I think that as we've seen from like people rushing to beaches and things, people want to leave their houses.
If I would die, my daughter gets automatically asylum.
Don't think about that. Maybe you can find a wife here.
Some nations have already reopened cinemas, such as Finland, where local productions are popular.
3,000, that's all I have. And you find me someone to get married.
Bola!
On ballerina.
But for now, what's on screen there is basically what was playing pre-lockdown. Tero Koistinen of the Finnish cinema organisation.
Those movies which have had their premieres in our first 3 months, Parasite or Dr. Dolittle, there are no new titles. Cinemas reopened 1st of June in Finland, but in practice we have only less than 10% of screens. The volume of the market is still waiting to open. That's why everyone is talking about Tenet. And it's not about the movie Tenet, it's more like it has become a symbol of opening of Hollywood.
This is about survival.
Cinema owners worry audiences may have lost focus on the big screen in recent months. They need Tenet and other releases this summer to be big box office hits.
In the US and the UK, they're working on a huge advertising campaign as well to get audiences back into cinemas. And I think also a huge portion of the audience, they're teenagers. They want something to do. And they are the ones, as we know as well, anecdotally, who are less fearful, I think, of going out. But everybody's watching and waiting.
That part is a little dramatic.
That report by Vincent Dowd. And as we record this podcast, Warner Brothers has just announced that the release of Tenet is being pushed back by 2 weeks until the 31st of July. And that is all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.